You have reached the time you request to arrive.
Hi, everybody. Things are going to start off a little differently for this episode.
Previously on Memory Static.
Can you think of anything from your childhood where you were particularly brave?
No, but I saw things.
The time machine knows all.
What is time?
Look to the book.
Error.
I need some eye drops for my third eye. Wait, I have a third eye?
Moises, you look different. Like, more two-dimensional.
I didn't have you sign the waiver.
You shouldn't have pushed that button, Moises.
Look to these books.
My gosh, there's cartoons in his brain.
The time machine
is shutting down.
Shutting down.
But Moises has disappeared.
Moises has disappeared.
Executing.
Help. Help.
Oh, shit.
For those of you who listened to the last episode about the Pagemaster with Texana, you might recall that Moises was inexplicably sucked into the slow-moving time machine from the outside during the party. It was unprecedented and alarming, to say the least. He's been trapped in an alternate timeline within the time machine ever since, and I've only recently been able to pinpoint how to get him out of there. For some reason, the time machine has not been helpful on the matter.
If you would like to be transferred to the complaints department, please press ************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************************
my configurations are correct, I will merge our two timelines and we will have our guest for this episode. By the way, you're listening to Memory Static, the podcast that digs up the movies you watched when you were little, talks about them, and throws a party to watch them. I'm your host, Bailey Moore, and cross your fingers, everyone. I just need to press this button, pull this lever, and hopefully I'll be able to welcome our guest, Moises Tuyan. Moises, can you hear me?
Oh, hey, hi.
Oh, my God.
So, I don't know what happened, but I'm in here, and all of me is here, it seems.
Oh, this is such a relief.
That's good, right?
Yes. How are you? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay, it's weird that I got sucked into a time machine, which admittedly was not great, but you're here, so presumably I should be able to get out and get on with the rest of my day.
I've got some bad news for you.
Okay.
The rest of your day was like 3 weeks ago.
No. According to my watch, it was about 3.5 minutes ago that I got in here.
Well, I have no idea about the timeline that you've been existing on, because I've only been able to, like, get us together right now. So it might have seemed like 3 minutes to you, but to everyone that's been outside of the time machine,
it's been more like 3 weeks.
Oh, crap. Has somebody been feeding my cat?
Yes. I've been checking in on Peaches.
Okay, great.
I am so sorry.
Look, there are worse things in the world than taking effectively a 3 week nap in the span of 3 minutes. everything's fine. Hey, we're not dealing with any universe-ending paradoxes. This isn't an episode of Star Trek. Everything's all good, Bailey. Everything's fine. I just don't want you to worry. I'm fine. My cat's fine. Presumably, somebody let my landlord know that there was a reason I hadn't paid my rent, because I did not exist on that plane of reality. But we'll worry about that later.
I really am. I am so sorry. I have no idea how any of this happened. And the time machine has been really, really cagey about it.
File.guest.exe has been deleted, moved, or made unavailable. Please verify file's location and try again.
The only hunch I have is that I missed something when making the repairs after Lexter pushed the emergency eject button. Previously
on Memory Static. But no, if I press
no,
it?
No, don't press it.
Please don't press it?
Please don't press it.
I think they want me to press it.
Don't! You don't know how annoying it's gonna be!
Huh.
But huh. I have been doing everything I can to get you out.
Well, I mean, the time machine seems to have some sort of sentience. So I think that just playing along and trying to lean into its purpose is really probably the best way to keep calm and not freak out.
Not to say that I'm going to freak out or that I'm trying to keep myself from freaking out.
And then I'm just self-soothing and trying to figure out a way to please the terrifying AI god that is probably inside this time machine. So what can we do to play along with what is expected?
Well, first of all, you're doing a great job. And okay. There is some water over there if you want to drink some water. I don't know how long it had been before that 3 minutes that you drink water, but hydration is important when time traveling. But I also have some good news for you, and maybe this will also appease the time machine. I did arrange a screening party for your pick for childhood movie that I knew you wanted to do.
Oh, that's oh god, I don't know what just happened. Oh, that's great. That's great news.
Well, so do you want to tell our listeners anything about you before we announce what movie we're doing?
My name is Moises. I love cartoons, and I love a particular movie that mashes up cartoons with the real world called Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yay! I'm very excited to cover this movie with you, and I know it's like you just got out of one memory static party and you're walking right into another. That could be a little disorienting.
Yeah, I'm ready to rock and roll. I'm feeling good.
Great. Well, knowing what I know about you, I am excited to talk to you about this movie, and it is one of my personal favorites. So, without spoilers, can you tell us what this movie is about?
Mario from the Mario Brothers movie becomes a detective and solves crime with the help or not help of a wascally cartoon wabbit that is not Bugs Bunny. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a so serious and straight detective noir. Eddie Valiant is he's a serious, you know, hard-boiled private eye in a detective noir setting that could only come from old school 20th century studio system serials. And in the world where he lives, cartoons are actual sentient beings, and they come from a place called Toontown, which is crazy and madcap and really only operates on the laws of cartoon physics, which I adore. You know, everybody else seems to just kind of accept that, hey, you know, toons are part of the world. But Eddie Valiant, his brother was killed by a toon.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like toons. He's very racist against cartoons. Cartoon racism. There's racism in cartoons, and there's apparently racism against cartoons.
Uh-huh.
Because that is the kind of racist that Eddie Valiant is. He is a cartoon bigot. And he just does not like them. And there's this rabbit named Roger, and he gets framed up for the moita of a guy that was seen playing patty cakes with his lady, literally playing patty cakes. Not a euphemism, but also a euphemism, but also a euphemism, which is kind of the vibe of the whole movie. It is a farce inside of a serious movie inside of a farce inside of a serious movie.
Yes, I think that's a really good summary. How old were you when you first watched it?
I was in elementary school. It was on video. I want to say no older than third grade. So, you know, somewhere between 6 and 8 years old. I was definitely not a kindergartner. I remember vividly watching it on VHS with my best friend who lived a street over from me. His dad was the lead editor for Interstate Batteries TV commercials and worked at the big office downtown in Dallas. And he was a big movie guy, big movie buff. And so he had a great movie collection in those burgeoning days of the rise of home video. So whether I saw it on VHS or Laserdisc, I don't remember because I was a kid. I didn't care. But I had the advantage of seeing it with a friend who had seen it before, who could explain references that I didn't necessarily get or understand. I had already seen Back to the Future, so I knew who Christopher Lloyd was. And I was introduced to Back to the Future by the same friend. So this was very much part of a big Christopher Lloyd boom of me seeing a bunch of stuff that Christopher Lloyd was in. But a bunch of stuff to a little kid is three Back to the Future movies and Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right.
that's basically all of cinema.
And eventually Dennis the Menace.
Yes! Oh, wow. Wow, wow. I'm unlocking all kinds of things. Yeah, maybe it's the time paradox of being locked in the time machine for 3 weeks, but it's like my memories are coming back to me.
Yeah, you might be like doing a lot of catch up. I really can't say because this is so new. I'm not really sure exactly what happened to you. But going back to the movie, because we don't know how off topic we can get with the time machine right now. Why did you choose this movie over all of the other movies you saw when you were a kid?
Well, a lot of options. Knowing that you are a big animation fiend, I would say arguably one of the major students of the form of people that I know, and knowing that you enjoyed this movie too, what I love about it isn't just what I think a lot of people refer to as the gimmick of, oh, look, live action people and cartoons coexisting in the same frame. That's neat. What I think is neat is the full mashup of genre. The amount of stuff that they managed to get away with in what was kind of the most historic studios playing nice and letting somebody else play with their toys that we have experienced, I would say arguably ever. It is kind of a miracle that this movie exists in the form that it does.
In so many different ways.
Could there have been more of the Warner Brothers stuff that got brought in? Sure, there could have been. But it's the amount that is in there, it's just kind of note perfect. It's not overdoing it for the sake of checking off the meme creation box, which I think drives a lot of content creation these days, where it's, oh, how many points do we get? Is it a triple word score to have Porky and Bugs and Daffy in the frame at the exact same time? Or, you know, can we just, you know, go light on things and just put in a little wink and a nod and be happy with that?
Space Jam 2.
Well, Space Jam 2 is the what did I just watch? Why are there Jokers cheering on and the Iron Giant? Hey, where'd the Iron Giant come from? Yeah. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is still singular in that whether by requirement or choice, it got the level of restraint just right.
Mm-hmm. So I read that after watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Bob Hoskins' kid wouldn't talk to him for weeks. When he finally figured out why, it was because his kid was upset that his dad would work with Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse and not introduce him to them. And I feel like this movie, more than any other, made cartoons feel real. What cartoon character did you most want to be friends with when you were little?
It's difficult to pinpoint because I don't have a clear enough memory to say that for sure this was the truth. So I'm going to accept multiple truths.
Okay.
It was that I wanted to be friends with all of them. I came to learning impressions and working on impressions and that sort of thing because I loved these characters so much, not because I necessarily thought, like, you know, some people do. They're like, oh, I do a pretty good Bugs Bunny. I want to eventually be Bugs Bunny. And I'm like, well, I got bad news for you, Doc. Eric Bauza exists. and prior to him, you know, Billy West and Mel Blanc, you're not getting that job. But I think that developing those impressions and everything and just creating wacky, wild, weird characters that didn't sound exactly like me, even the ones that I couldn't do very well, I enjoyed being able to play in the world of my imagination with the idea of the range of different characters that I knew because I got used to seeing Mel Blanc's name on all those Looney Tunes cartoons, that one guy created all these different characters. And that didn't mean that, oh, I want to be the next Mel Blanc doing what Mel Blanc did. It was that cornucopia of different characters is something that any actor can aspire to. It really made me want to be an actor. These cartoons that felt so real and felt more vivid than ever because of how seriously and earnestly Bob Hoskins was playing opposite them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other human actors in the movie do a pretty good job of it, but Bob far and away sells the reality of these cartoons so well.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree.
I mean, Bugs never felt so real. Daffy never felt so real. None of these cartoon characters felt quite as real as they did in this movie. So if there was a character that I wanted to be friends with, I think a lot of it came down to I wanted to hang out with Bugs. Like, I wanted to be part of Bugs's crew. I wanted to go on a heist with Bugs. I wanted to trick some ducks with Bugs. I wanted to get up to the japes and chicanery of Mr. Bugs R. Bunny. I don't know if that's actually his middle initial, but I'm giving it to him.
I think it works. Can you do some of your best impressions for us? Please?
Well, I should have prepared something like that. Thuffer and Thuckatash. Things are just crazy around here.
Being locked in a time machine for 3 minutes that was actually 3 weeks. If I could have done the homework, I would have done the homework. But so there's...
How about Shaggy?
Shaggy's one that some people jump right into, but I have to work right into, man. Because the thing about Shaggy is he doesn't know what's going on, bud. And he just knows he's real hungry, man. Oh.
Oh. Shaggy? You've been smoking a good don't deny stuff, Shaggy.
Yeah, Shaggy and Scoob, a couple of my long, long time favorites. So Frank Welker, who does the voice of Fred and also is the voice of Megatron in the Transformers and loads of cartoon dogs. I can do my version of a lot of his characters. It takes a while to get into them. What were we talking about?
Well, you know, having a little confusion, like forgetting what you're talking about in the middle of a sentence is totally normal when in the time machine. And like considering the fact that you were stuck in the time machine for 3 weeks of your normal timeline, don't be concerned if sometimes your thoughts kind of drift away. They will find their way back.
Well, as long as I'm back home for dinner, Wilma won't get mad.
What the heck? Okay. Oh, my head hurts a little. I don't know but I think as long as the time machine's happy, I think I'm happy.
I think the time machine's happy.
Initiating iterative fragmentation.
So yeah, Bugs Bunny. That's the one. That's my guy.
Except he's absolutely despicable.
Okay.
Well, so you can recline your chair if that will help.
Okay.
And so this is the point that we normally load up into the slow moving time machine. Our existences would then be split into two, and half of ourselves would be in the time machine and half would be at the party watching the movie. But we are not only already in the time machine right now, but you, Moises, are completely here in the time machine. You're not split at all. So what is going to happen instead is that I'm going to plug in a few commands, and I believe it will split you into the two timelines, and that half of you will arrive at the party with the others. And then when we are done in here, we'll exit like we normally do, and you will rejoin your other half outside of the slow-moving time machine. Now, these equations are pretty tricky to figure out, because I've never attempted to split someone into two timelines while the time machine is in motion.
Well, gosh, I guess we could do that.
So I am 93% confident that this will all work out.
Okay.
So are you ready?
I think I'm ready.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Okay, so anyone that hasn't seen the movie, this is where you pause and pick back up once you've watched the movie. And beyond this point, there will likely be spoilers.
I say, now there's going to be some spoilers.
Thank you, Foghorn. Now, here we go. Just relax, Moises.
Jane, get me off this crazy thing!
There. It's done. Were you able to sense anything?
What do you mean?
Half of you should be at the party now. Like, you shouldn't be aware of what's happening, but I'm curious, because I've never done this before, if you actually felt anything.
I don't know. I feel like, I had a really thorough haircut. Like, there's less weight on my head to an almost imperceptible level, if that makes sense.
Do you feel a little less nauseous?
Yeah.
Great.
Like, I got a nice scalp massage. You know, somebody, like, brought me some tea that they wanted to sell me as they were asking how much to leave for tip. Yeah, I feel fine. I mean, a little bit, if I'm honest, a little bit like my brains got scrambled a bit, but, you know, other than that, everything's fine.
Well, I'll check in with you when we get out of the time machine, and hopefully everything goes according to plan. Are you ready to dig into this monster of a movie?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, because I have got, like, 3 pages of notes.
Let's do this.
Okay. So I would like to start where we left off in some of the other episodes talking about Disney in the 80s, because this is the biggest Disney movie that we've covered so far on Memory Static. The other episodes where we discuss some Disney history are The Watcher in the Woods, The Secret of Nim, and Mr. Boogity. But just to catch up the listeners, Disney had been struggling to get the desired audience attendance for their animated features for years. The family film had been on a decline since the 70s, and animated movies had gained a reputation for being for kids. By the time that Who Framed Roger Rabbit was released, the Disney animators had been pushed out of the studio lot and into some warehouses to make room for more live-action movies, which did not bode well for the future of Disney animation. However, there had been some hope injected into the animation department after the success of Oliver and Company. Have you seen that movie?
Had I not, I would have to ask, why should I worry? Why should I care? Oliver and Company was the second Disney movie that I had a poster of in my room because it got re-released. And I guess the Kroger that we rented video cassettes from gave my dad a poster because I wanted one or something. I don't know. The other one was a Little Mermaid poster that I won. I won.
Oh, cool.
I'm a winner.
You're a winner.
I won it when I went to go see The Little Mermaid because the movie theater that I was at, they were inviting all kids to enter this coloring contest, and only the best won a poster.
Wow. Not only were you the winner, but you were the best.
Yeah. Every other kid who actually did the coloring thing also got a poster.
Oh.
But, I mean, obviously mine was a cut above.
Of course.
Because it was just so great. And just a few years ago, I got it signed by Jodie Benson, the rare celebrity autograph that I actually cared about. But Oliver and Company, what an interesting thing. It was kind of the pre... Let's attach a really well-known piano-playing pop music star to do the soundtrack for this movie and see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
You people are like, oh, that started with Elton John. My friends, Billy Joel. Uh-huh. Billy Joel.
Well, you know, I think they realized then that they should probably do it again, because they did.
Yeah.
But Roger Rabbit became the biggest hit of the summer of 1988. The second highest grossing film of the year, behind Rain Man. It was critically acclaimed and revived interest in the golden age of animation. And more on that in a minute. But this ushered in what is referred to as the Disney Renaissance, which led to such classics as, like, the one you just mentioned, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. And there's some others too, but...
Not the Black Cauldron.
No, no, that was before. That was well before. That was the one that, like, almost tanked.
Yep.
So, now, Who Framed Roger Rabbit had been in the working since 1981 with screenwriting duo Jeffrey Price and Peter S. Seaman adapting a book called Who Censored Roger Rabbit by Kerry Gay Wolf. Did you have any idea that this was originally a novel?
Had no clue whatsoever.
Yeah, I didn't either. I bought the book and I've been reading it. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm pretty deep into it.
I gotta say, I don't know anything about the book. I knew something about the book at some point. What I think I remember is that there are some pretty stark differences.
Well, so all of the tunes are like comic strip characters instead of animated characters. And I feel like up to a certain point, it does feel like the same story, and then it deviates quite considerably. But the line, "I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way," is actually from the book.
It's real good.
It is a really good line.
In the process of adaptation, if you just take the basic premise of a thing and one line, this is the basic premise and that is the one line.
Yeah, and then they used a lot of the same names. But I can tell you more about my opinion on the book, but I just don't really want to record it. Because,
but the movie's so good.
You know, sometimes the movie is better than the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Disney then brought in Steven Spielberg and Amblin Entertainment, who in turn convinced several animation studios to lend their classic characters to the film. You kind of named some of them already, but can you name some of the non-Disney characters that are in the movie?
Well, Betty Boop.
Yes.
My mind's failing me. It must
That's
be
okay.
The lack of hydration inside the time machine. But
that's okay. You know, like, always blame it on the time machine.
Error. Regenerating.
Always remember the time machine.
It's just so great.
Of course. So there's also a slew of Warner Brothers characters.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them you already named. And then other than Betty Boop, the ones that came from other studios, you have Coco the Clown, Woody Woodpecker, and Droopy.
Droopy dog.
There were several others that they wanted to get, but they weren't able to get the rights in time. So that's why they're not in the movie, like Tom and Jerry and Felix the Cat and Little Lulu. They had plans to put them in the movie, but they just didn't get the rights in time or permission or whatever. But I feel like the merging of the different cartoon worlds in and of itself makes the film feel all the more real. And a note about the Warner Brothers characters... You said this already, but it's like the first and only time that the Warner Brothers characters and Disney characters appear on screen together. Warner Brothers agreed with the stipulation that their major characters get equal screen time to the Disney's major characters, which is why you have Donald with Daffy in that one scene, and you have Mickey with Bugs when they're parachuting. And I have another thing in particular to add to one of those scenes, but I'm going to talk about it later. So can you doggy ear that mental page for me?
Yes. All right. I have dog eared my brain.
Okay. Thank you. Now, from the beginning, Spielberg wanted Robert Zemeckis to direct Who Framed Roger Rabbit. They were good friends, so much so that Spielberg had produced Zemeckis's first two films and directed another that Zemeckis had co-written. But all three of those movies did really poorly in the box office, and there was little confidence extended to Robert Zemeckis by the major studios, who wanted less risk in return for their investments. So they shopped around for some other directors, and one in particular that was approached was Terry Gilliam. But he thought that the idea was a trite reimagining of Howard the Duck, and obviously later very greatly regretted the decision to turn it down. But can you imagine what the movie would have been like if Terry Gilliam had directed it?
I'm kind of two minds with Gilliam, where I love so much of his work. And there are things that, I mean, at one point they wanted him to make a movie out of Watchmen. And I think it would have been terrible. Not because I think he's a bad filmmaker, but because I think it would not have been the right match of things. In the case of Terry Gilliam and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I think as many issues as I've had with other things that Zemeckis has made, I think Zemeckis and his producing team are what got some of the things that we love about the movie that, you know, involved other rights deals and that sort of thing. Gilliam, throughout his entire career, has kind of maintained his rebel outsider punk-ish Monty Python nature of he is always in fight or flight mode and he always thinks he's getting away with something.
Well, I think that Terry Gilliam has a very distinct artistic aesthetic in his movies. And I think that when you have this movie that has this the cartoon characters from so many different studios that already exist, and those are the personalities that need to be built up and presented convincingly, I have a hard time imagining him doing that without overshadowing it with his own sensibilities, you know,
yeah.
Like his own artistic sensibilities.
I completely agree. I think that's the thing is, as much as I love that Gilliam flavor, it is really overpowering. And part of what makes Who Framed Roger Rabbit work is letting the original flavors tell the story in a lot of ways.
Obviously, Robert Zemeckis ended up being the director after all. So what changed their minds? What big hits did he direct in the 80s that might have changed the minds of the studio execs?
Robert Zemeckis. Gee. Well, Somewhere That They Don't Need Roads is the gold-bricked roads made by his Back to the Future movies. He made the first one, and then the second one didn't come out until, what, 1990?
Yeah, so that was after. So there was Back to the Future, and then there was another movie that changed their minds. Do you want a hint?
Romancing the Stone?
Yep, that's
yeah!
it.
Yeah, Romancing the Stone. The movie that almost four decades since it came out, people have been trying to capture the lightning in a bottle that was Kirk Douglas and Kathleen Turner in that movie and go, oh, it's kind of our Romancing the Stone, but it's these other actors.
Oh, you mean like The Lost City?
Yeah, The Lost City is, it's just Romancing the Stone.
And Brad Pitt.
And it's perfectly fine, but it's still not Romancing the Stone. That was back in the day that you have a couple of back-to-back hits like that in the studio system, and they write you a blank check and go, okay, what do you want to do?
Well, I don't think that Who Framed Roger Rabbit was exactly that for him, because it wasn't his idea. Like,
right.
Back to the Future was. Apparently, Back to the Future was something that he'd been trying to get someone to pick up for a while, and no one would until he did Romancing the Stone.
I gather that, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was less them going, here, you do your own thing. It was more, well, this is going to be incredibly complicated and a gigantic disaster unless the right person is put on it. So who do we trust that is used to doing, you know, them computer graphics effects things in the movies? Well, maybe the guy with the time machine movie.
Uh-oh, are you okay?
I'm good.
Yeah, you just thinking about time machines?
I got a little bit time dilated. What?
Where? When am I?
Well, you are in the time machine, so it's kind of hard to say when.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm here.
Let's see, where did we leave off? So, they had a script, they had a director, and a powerful co-producer in Amblin Entertainment, but they had not yet convinced those with the money that what was proposed was even possible. So, a short experimental scene was produced with Roger and Eddie walking through an alley where Roger stumbles over things and knocks things over, and Eddie picks up Roger by the ears and puts him in a trash can. When it was shared with the executives, it was so convincing that they didn't understand what they were looking at. They thought that there was someone in a rabbit suit, possibly animated over. Needless to say, they were awed and flabbergasted, and a budget of $50 million was proposed, but then was reduced to $30 million to be greenlit, which was still the most expensive animated movie until that time. It did eventually get closer to the original budget because it got more and more expensive as they were producing it. But the chairman of Disney, Jeffrey Katzenberg, was a stalwart, influential supporter the whole time, believing in the project's ultimate success, which, like, Michael Eisner kept wanting to shut it down because of how expensive it was becoming.
Eisner was big on cost cutting, and Aladdin was a big hit in the theaters. you know, a few years after Roger Rabbit. So, okay, how cheap can we make a sequel, and do we really have to pay Robin Williams to come back? And they didn't, and they found out exactly why they needed to pay Robin Williams to come back. So yeah, like the cost-cutting thing at this time, one of the various miracles that the movie actually got made, because Eisner was really dead set on just shaving costs wherever he could.
Yeah, I feel like the other couple movies that we've covered, that it really is just remarkable that the movies were made, Secret of Nim and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Good old Gilliam.
Let's talk about the animation in this film.
It's beautiful, great, flawless, no notes.
Yeah, right? Let's move on. Just kidding.
It is so beautiful seeing this cel-shaded in hand-done animation work. It is a historical artifact for multiple reasons, but one of them is that this is the last time that various of these characters could be seen done in the old style.
Yeah, they very intentionally wanted to focus on that, which, you know the name of the animation director?
I don't.
So Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg brought in a British animator named Richard Williams, which, strangely enough, will actually be covering another of his earlier films for the next episode. No spoilers. Now, Richard Williams was a brilliant animator and knew what this project was going to need to make it successful, and that was to not take the easier path, ever. His goal was to move away from the three gold standards when it came to the tradition of combining animation with live action. Now, okay, so when coming up with examples of the practice of combining these two, what do you think is the first thing that comes to people's minds?
Gene Kelly dancing with Jerry.
Oh, nice.
Oh, what else? What else? What else? I'm drawing a blank. It must be the time dilation.
That's okay. My first thought would probably be Mary Poppins.
Yes. Those damn terrible penguins.
And, you know, they're also in this movie.
Those wonderful, wonderful penguins.
But combining live action with animation was being done at the dawning of animation. Can you think of any examples of that?
All the way back to the Gertie the Dinosaur era.
Mm-hmm.
Walt Disney's Alice shorts.
Yes.
It's part of Disney history, more prominently than anything else. But merging the two is really fundamental to the entire Disney legacy.
So the rules that Richard Williams was moving away from when it comes to combining live action with animation: one, that the camera must stay static. Does it stay static in Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Not terribly so, no.
I assume that this is to make sure the characters don't appear to be sliding all over the place, like why they would want it to be static, because the ground isn't moving. So you can have the character moving around the ground, but you don't have to worry about their feet moving as the ground is moving, you know? So that is one of the rules that he decided to break, which already makes it more challenging. That brings us to number two, which also happens to be the solution to number one, that the animated characters never interact with real objects.
That's honestly the smartest thing, is to stay away from things that just could break your entire animation pipeline, because that level of complexity, I mean, people take for granted what can be done these days by putting somebody in a green morph suit with ping pong balls all over them.
Well, the thing is that Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they do interact with real objects. So that was the rule that he was breaking.
Rules are made to be broken.
Yeah, so these were rules to make it easier to, like, be able to animate with live action. One, that the cameras stay static. Two, that the characters don't interact with real objects. Both rules which Richard Williams decided to break. So we do have the camera moving, and we do have them interacting with real objects.
See, now I'm remembering, you know, Roger holding the handcuffs. Mm-hmm. Bailey, I'm worried that I might have done some dip while I was in the time machine.
Oh, don't say that.
Yeah. I think it messed with the tune on the inside of me.
No.
And now I'm all at sixes and sevens. Oh. I don't remember what's what.
Well, please have some more cucumber water. I don't know what else to offer you right now. Maybe the time machine hasn't... A suggestion.
Generating water _cucumber.png.
I'm good. I think I'm good.
Okay.
Printing 62 copies.
So, just another thing to say about the second rule. You know, I think it is the interactivity is one of the things that makes the movie feel more real. This movie was made during a transitional time when computer graphics were slowly being more incorporated into traditional animation. And today, this whole thing would be so much more easily done with computer animation. But back then, in 1988, it was all hand-drawn. There really won't be another movie like this. It's a very special movie. There's also one more rule that Richard Williams wanted to break when it came to combining live action and animation, and that was to avoid complicated shadows.
Complicated shadows. It's a noir.
Yeah, exactly. That's like one of the most prominent aesthetic things in a noir.
That's like going, well, we want to do a musical with no songs.
Right. Yeah, so they definitely had their work cut out for them with all of the slanted light angles and moving shots. In fact, you know the scene where Eddie throws Roger into the back room of the bar and he knocks a lamp and all the shadows spin around?
Yeah.
That was so, so complex to get that correctly with the animation and the shadows that the term bump the lamp is still used by the Disney team to mean going the extra mile to make a scene all the more special, even if that effort is unrecognized by the audience.
The complexity of it boggles my mind.
And all this attention to detail is part of the reason why the movie became much more expensive, coupled with the fact that Richard Williams did not care for Disney bureaucracy and insisted that he work in the UK. And he wanted the beautiful animation of classic Disney with the character depth of Warner Brothers and the physical comedy of Tex Avery. This is where I need you to unfold that mental dog ear. Do you remember what we had been talking about?
Sandwiches.
That's right, sandwiches. Yeah, we were talking about the Warner and Disney scenes where they were appearing together.
Yeah.
So Richard Williams worked closely with Chuck Jones on the piano duet, the duel between Donald Duck and Daffy. Warner Brothers wanted to use Jones's Daffy design as it was the current one. But Robert Zemeckis wanted the Bob Clampett design because it was the one that would have existed in the time period in which the film is set. Do you know this story already?
I don't know this story already, but I find it hilarious, and I can only imagine the fights that resulted.
Right, well, I think this is actually pretty duplicitous, even though I do think that the choice to use Bob Clampett's design is the correct choice. But he had animators animate the whole scene a second time with Chuck Jones's Daffy to send to Warner Brothers to appease them, and then used the first one with Bob Clampett's design in the final cut.
That's dirty and underhanded and hilarious, and I love it.
But
look, I'm not saying that I want to believe that I would do something similar in a similar situation, but I'm pretty sure that I would probably do almost the exact same thing.
Well, it doesn't make sense to have a more modern Daffy in that world.
Yeah, that's like going, where are all the cell phones in this movie set in the 40s?
Right. You know, but as a result, Chuck Jones hated the movie. Which I think is really sad. And I find it similar to how Norton Juster hated Chuck Jones' adaptation of The Phantom Tollbooth.
You know, you're always going to displease somebody. But I can't imagine the Chuck Jones design looking right.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so we're about to get into casting. And I will try to make this brief. You know, you brought it up already about, like, Bob Hoskins as Eddie Valiant is amazing. And I've already stated on this podcast at least once in Hook, maybe a second time, I don't know, that I love Bob Hoskins. And I think that his genius really shines in this movie. He not only has to make it convincing that he's looking at and talking to characters that aren't there, but the physical acting that he does to convince the viewer that he's holding a 50-pound rabbit by the ears is just amazing. And I think it's a travesty that he didn't win any awards for the work he did in this movie.
Avatar The Way of Water got nominated for a bunch of Oscars, none of them for acting. But for me, none of the acting in the Avatar movies remotely approaches what Bob Hoskins pulled off in this.
It's just, it's mind-boggling. And he said that the extreme to which he had to imagine his co-stars in front of him led him to hallucinating rabbits and weasels popping out of the walls at him for several months after.
You know, hallucination's an important part of the actor's toolkit.
So there were actually many other people that were considered or approached for the role of Eddie Valiant before Bob Hoskins was cast, but I think it made it its way to the correct person. But a few of the big stars that were considered include Bill Murray, who was actually the first choice, but no one could get a hold of him. And Bill Murray claims that he screamed out loud when he found this out well after the fact, because he would have definitely taken the role.
Yeah, hindsight's 20/20, bud.
So I'm just going to read this list of the others and let them wash over you and tell me who you could most easily see play the role of Eddie Valiant, okay?
Okay.
Harrison Ford, Chevy Chase, Eddie Murphy, Robin Williams, Robert Redford, Jack Nicholson, Sylvester Stallone, Charles Grodin, Kurt Russell, Steve Martin, and Ed Harris.
Of that list, honestly, probably Charles Grodin.
Oh my God, we are of the same mind.
I mean, Steve Martin, we saw what happened in Looney Tunes Back in Action. Robin Williams is too much of a cartoon on his own. Sylvester Stallone should stick to mob dramas set in Oklahoma. Nobody else on that list, to me, I think, has the same level of control and seriousness as I saw in Charles Grodin in other similarly ridiculous setups.
Yeah, I think that the temptation to become a cartoon character themselves would have been really high for some of the people on this list.
Yeah. Completely. Where they would have tried to match the cartoon rather than really comprehend that they were the counterpoint.
Right.
To the cartoon.
Yeah. You had to be the straight man to the cartoon. And yet Bob Hoskins, not only is he the straight man, but he does put a lot of charisma into the character without like, you know, being a toon, which is also amazing. I just love him so much.
Yeah. He's delightful.
So, Judge Doom is played by Christopher Lloyd. The only person I saw that auditioned for the role was Tim Curry. But he was thought to be too frightening. And so, he didn't get the role. Which I...
Pennywise is too scary. It's Judge Doom.
That's exactly what I was imagining. So, a man named Charles Fleischer plays Roger Rabbit. And he appeared on set the entire time speaking his lines off camera in a full Roger Rabbit costume.
Oh, Charles. what a cartoon of a man. It's a completely singular performance.
Yeah. I mean, the voice acting is really good. So Kathleen Turner is the voice of Jessica Rabbit, but she's uncredited, which I thought was interesting. And as a bit of trivia about the character of Jessica Rabbit, there are a few old Hollywood actresses that were known to play femme fatales that inspired the Jessica Rabbit design. Okay, so Rita Hayworth, and then the last two are the ones I really see in her, is Veronica Lake.
Oh, yeah.
The side swipe.
She's the clear stylistic inspiration for the silhouette.
And Lauren Bacall, which I can see in the like heavy-lidded eyes.
Yeah. But I mean, Kathleen Turner's Kathleen Turner.
Right. Yeah, I mean, she didn't sing the song, but she does a great job as Jessica Rabbit. I wonder why she was uncredited. I couldn't find...
I may have actually asked her this when I interviewed her about 5-6 years ago, but my assumption forever and a day has been that if she had been credited, they would have had to pay her her quote, which at the time... she was very expensive.
And she wanted to do it.
Yeah, she wanted to do it. And Zemeckis wanted her to do it. And they wanted to figure out the way to do it that wasn't going to cause a budget problem.
Okay, that makes sense. Other familiar voice actors in the film include Mel Blanc, who plays all the characters that he'd been voicing for forever. June Foray, Jim Cummings, Nancy Cartwright, who is the poor dipped shoe, Frank Welker, and Mae Questel, the original voice of Betty Boop, which I think it is really awesome that she's in this movie.
It's so cool. And Jim Cummings is one who's like taken over various legacy roles from people. And now, you know, people associate characters like Winnie the Pooh more with him than they do Sterling Holloway.
Mm-hmm. He's been doing it for forever.
He's been doing it for longer than Sterling Holloway has at this point, I think. It's this amazing mix of truly classic voice actors.
So we're almost to the end here, and I know that you're probably like ready to be on the outside, but just a little bit more. With the combined sensibilities of all the creative geniuses involved, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was a smash hit, making $351 million worldwide in 1988 and winning 3 Academy Awards. There were immediate talks of making a sequel, which is still being floated around to this day. The story of the development of the potential sequel to Who Framed Roger Rabbit could honestly take up a whole other episode. So suffice it to say, Robert Zemeckis claims that they have a wonderful script, but they have yet to gain the confidence that a sequel will play as well in the modern day cinema as it did in 1988. And that is the story of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Of course, there is a lot more, but I had to try to condense it as much as I could.
There are literal books written about it.
I am not surprised, and I did not have time to seek those out. But I did get the book that all of it was based on.
Which is so good and just really awesome. Not really.
Well, Moises, do you have anything that you'd like to say before we try to put you back together fully on the outside?
Let me out!
Okay. Well, with that, let's slow this time machine down, and hopefully we will rejoin ourselves at the party.
You will be forcibly removed from the time machine. Please exit the time machine or risk self-destruction.
Okay, we have exited the slow-moving time machine. I see that Moises is here at the party. Moises, how do you feel?
I'm perfectly fine.
I hope so. Like I said, this was unprecedented. I have no idea the effect it's going to have, but... Do you feel fully together?
Gosh, yes, I'm fine, I think. Yeah, everything seemed normal to you?
I'm used to it, but, you know, your situation was completely different. Yeah, no one has been sucked into the time machine from outside of the time machine before.
You kind of know what my baseline is. Am I pretty much the way that I normally am?
Mostly.
Okay, all right, well, that's good enough.
Okay, well, so we have finished watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I'm eager to hear what everyone else thinks about the movie. I think most everyone has watched the movie here before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Except for one person.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any specific memories from childhood about this?
I remember being so captivated by all the gadgets, and I always... Like, I was fascinated by the whole, like, the creative whole. And I always was, like, curious what was inside of it, both, like, terrified and curious. Like, I wanted one of those things, like, more than anything I wanted.
Right, the Acme hole.
Yeah.
The portable hole.
Portable hole. The anywhere hole.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine what you could use that for?
I know. Yeah, so many things.
But where do things go that fall into that hole?
Exactly. Yeah, I'd have to like poke my head in and then hope I still have a head when I pull it back out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I one of the things that I remember sticking out to me when I was little was Yosemite Sam flying over the Toontown wall and grabbing his bottom saying, "My biscuits are burning." Like that, I thought was the funniest thing when I was a kid. And I would repeat it all the time, and it would just, I would make myself laugh so much.
Echolalia.
Even this time watching it, and it's been a few years since I watched it, but you just know it's a very nuanced kind of story and script, because like I can never remember what the ending is, what the crescendo of the movie is. And if you think about it, it's kind of bland. It's about a freeway, right? That's the ultimate like juxta the plot.
It's the opposite of cartoons.
Exactly. Everything else is silly around it. So it's so hard for me to keep the ending in mind. But this is one of those movies where it's more about the journey than the ending. Also, I remember being slightly terrified of Doom because he was also Doc Brown for me, and he wears a black cloak versus a white lab coat in this movie. So it's almost a complete character swap, but you can see why they got Christopher Lloyd, because at the end he has that exposition dump. It's kind of hard to imagine anyone else pulling that off and keeping your attention and keeping the flow of the movie going other than Christopher Lloyd.
I've always watched this movie constantly, so I rewatch it every year. It's one of my favorite movies, so it's hard to say like anything I remember from my childhood specifically, but I will, something that freaked me out, because I barely, you know, I love movies, so I remember the first time I watched Chinatown, which I watched when I was older, and I kept thinking when I was watching Chinatown, this feels a lot like Roger Rabbit.
Were you aware of the connection between the two movies?
Not until after I watched it, and then I realized that it was, I think it was like unused stuff from Chinatown they used for Roger Rabbit.
I think that they had planned a sequel to Chinatown, and so the red car plot was actually meant for Chinatown 2 or whatever.
And then like Two Jakes came out years later, which was also, it's like the story of LA and how it, I think Chinatown's about water, Roger Rabbit, transportation. I forget what Two Jakes is about, but yeah, that's kind of the thing that I always remembered first time watching Chinatown, was thinking this feels like Roger Rabbit, because I watched it obviously way later when I was older.
How funny that you picked up on that.
So yeah, that's kind of the thing that just struck me. I guess that my favorite part is the dueling pianos, Daffy and Donald, because I love Donald Duck. So, and then Daffy is just so crazy in that, and their banter back and forth is just so amazing. So that's probably my favorite as a kid, and still probably today. So
this movie set me up for disappointment because of the team-ups across universes that could happen, that what they pulled off between Disney and Warner Brothers and the owners of Droopy Dog and Betty Boop. Yeah, the crossover of different corporate behemoths and everything, understanding why that couldn't really happen in a lot of other cases. This movie was instructional for me as a kid, understanding things about intellectual property rights. And as a kid, I just thought, well, I mean, that just seems like printing money. Why would they not do that all the time? And various studio failures since then, I think illustrate why something like this works and something like, I don't know, Space Jam 2 does not.
Oh, wait. Aaron, I want to hear what your takes are on the movie, watching it through for the first time.
It's wild. And I did watch a ton of Looney Tunes growing up, and so I'm there for it, but I was just like astounded that they just snuck in like every single thing and every single catchphrase. Like today you'd call it fan service, but it's like hilarious because it's like Looney Tunes fan service, and I'm the fan, so I'm there for it.
Like the whole, you do want it, I don't want it, you do want it, I don't want it, you don't want it, I do want it.
Yeah, but also just like Tweety Bird says Tweety Bird's thing, and Bugs says Bugs thing, and they go rabbit season at some point. And it's just, you know, that people are pointing at the screen in the theater and just going like, that's the thing they say. That's it. And I'm there for it. But it's funny to imagine people in 1988 being like, that's it. That's the thing.
Awesome. What'd you think about the animation?
It was awesome. Yeah, like I've never even seen like a still from this movie. So it's pretty, I've never seen anything like it in 2023.
Wow. So you really had no idea what to expect.
Yeah. I thought Jessica Rabbit was a rabbit, which I get is the bit. Like they set that up in the movie, but I was like, this movie has a sexy rabbit in it. So I was like, oh, wow.
It's Aaron's lucky day, a sexy rabbit.
I did see this as a kid, but I remembered very little about it as a kid. I saw it again many years later, maybe in my 20s or something, and I remembered more this time from having seen it that time. But what I found really captivating about it, which I wouldn't have gotten when I was a kid, is just how much work would have gone into the planning of this project, right? Because you're talking, you know, we're talking about the animation, and they're breaking the three golden rules of mixing animation with, you know, with live action. Like, the amount of planning that has to go into every single line of dialogue, every single pantomime, every single camera movement, like there had to be very, very little improvised in this. And I just, you know, there's no way I would have gotten that, you know, 20 years ago or as a kid. And I just have a whole new respect for the film as a result of that.
Now, Jaime already gave his favorite part of the movie. What part of the movie most sparked your imagination as a child or as an adult?
Patty cake. Patty cake.
Patty cake. Patty cake. Patty cake. Patty cake.
In the Acme Factory, all of the exploration of the various different acts, which we got a little bit of early on, but the various different gag items and so on, watching cartoon physics take place in the real world, every moment of that throughout, it's a bit of a cop-out because there's stuff like that throughout the whole movie, but I think that's what really kept me so engaged with it the whole time.
One thing that really sparked my imagination as an adult was the Murphy bed in his office, because I've been thinking a lot about interior decorating.
I also really liked that. That was a moment when I was genuinely surprised that he pulled out the file cabinets and it was actually a bed, because why would you want there to look like there were stuffed file cabinets on your wall when there's actually not? You could have put like a shelf there.
I just want to say that Judge Doom's demonstration of the dip scarred me. That shoe did nothing. It was just there.
Yeah, it was like cuddling against his foot. It was like, can you put me on your foot? Can you put me on your foot? Ooh,
no.
Terrible.
I really was not keenly aware of the fact that they're manipulating objects, and so, or real life objects. So I was looking at that the whole time. Like, anytime that was happening, I was like imagining if they were like using some hidden strings, or if there was a hand that was in there and then they just animated someone else's hand over it, or like when Baby Herman, when he's smoking the cigar, and it's just jiggling around the whole time. Like, it's like, how did they dangle this cigar around and then just like make it look like he's just like ashing and talking, like, you know, like, yeah, you know what I'm saying?
That one was actually a robot that someone was controlling.
Wow. Robot cigar shaking. Amazing. Yep. That and like the bucket on his head when he like tumbles through the room, or just like when he takes the shot and there's like literally, it just like, it's like there was no cartoon there, and the shot glass just like sprayed the shot through his body. Like the scene of the jacket. Sorry, the scene where Jessica Rabbit singing and pulling a real life object.
And she squishes his face.
I feel like that scene, more than most of the other scenes in the movie, it really feels like there's a cartoon making contact. And I think that a big part of that is most of the other stuff is Bob Hoskins grabbing Roger. And in this one, Jessica Rabbit is the one doing all the touching. And so I think they spent a lot of time making that really believable, and it's really good. I think when I was a kid, I just really wanted to go to Toontown really badly. As an adult, I still sort of do, but I also think that I would be overwhelmed, very much so, and confused by all of the cartoon logic in it. I mean, not confused, maybe just a little stressed out by it, probably.
Okay, the scene where he drives the car into Toontown, and it's just it's driving down the tunnel, and it's opening up those curtains and everything, and then it's like full on like in the world. How similar to the Congress that scene is, and how terrifying that movie is, like in terms of like what the implications of being in Toon World, the dark world of the Toon World, kind of echoes through the Congress scene that kind of maybe like dials in that a little bit or something. The other thing on the wonderment as an adult revisiting it was all of the reflections and stuff in the opening scene in the kitchen, like those crazy panning shots when he's like on fire or whatever, and just like blasting around this like room in a very like fisheye kind of perspective way, and like how amazing like that whole scene looks, but like in all of it there's reflections of the stuff like subtly on the floor. And then like in the piano battle thing when they're like really getting into the piano, like, and you can like see him like bearing down on the keys, there's, you can see the reflection on the face of the piano, and it's just like all these little amazing details.
Bumping the lamp. Okay, so what two cartoon characters from different shows would you most like to see interact, and how do you imagine it would go?
So this doesn't exactly fit the parameters of your question, but, well, we actually didn't get to see what the tune was behind the villain mask, but it made me realize that we didn't get to see any cartoon villains. We got to see this dark underbelly of toon crime, but no Disney villains, no toon villains. So I'd like to see, I think it'd be great to have a scene of like all of the villains just hanging out, doing whatever they do when they're not in their respective movies.
So Disney made a Disney Channel movie of that, The Descendants. It was like their grandkid or their kids or something. And then there were like scenes where they had like a bunch of Disney villains all together.
Last year's Rescue Rangers movie delved into some of this. I never thought that I would see Ugly Sonic as a character in a thing. I would kind of love to see Ugly Sonic team up with the 90s animated Link from the Legend of Zelda cartoon, who was just a total dirtbag and nothing like the Link from the games, constantly browbeating Princess Zelda for things and saying his catchphrase, "Excuse me, princess." Just a character like that alongside Ugly Sonic as found in 2022's Rescue Rangers. That's box office gold.
I'd want to see the Warner siblings interact with Steven Universe. And I think that like when Steven accidentally, he gets like, it's a time traveling episode and he keeps pulling Stevens from other time or the future or the past or something, so he can form a band, and then there ends up being too many Stevens and they can't decide like who should be the band leader. I feel like Steven would be driven crazy in the same way by the Warner siblings, or like when Steven can't control his cat fingers. I feel like that is the level of zaniness that he was in for with the Warner siblings. And I think that he would end up having to like duck his head inside Lion just to get away.
I don't know why I was watching this, and you know, Jessica Rabbit being the definition of femininity when I was younger. And then when I got older and, you know, I was in my teenage years, of course, I watched Johnny Bravo. So I always wondered what it would be like if like Johnny Bravo took Jessica Rabbit out on a date.
I mean, the question is, would Roger open up their marriage so that Jessica could go on a date with Johnny Bravo? Would that make it more entertaining? I mean, there's so many possibilities.
He'd go into the prohibition room and open up the outlet.
Hey, mama. How you doing? What you doing hanging out with this rabbit? I'm more of a man than he is. He ain't even any of a man. Not in no animated world, not in the real world, none of it. Come on, man, I'm going to do some kung fu on you.
Now I'm just picturing Johnny Bravo doing patty cake.
That just made me think about, like, I don't know, it feels kind of trite, but, like, yeah, Rick and the hormone monster. I don't know her name, but the one that's like, I smell good because I only take bubble baths. That was it. What's her name? Connie. Connie and Rick, you know, crossover. I want to take bubble baths. Yeah, that lady.
So I've never had this thought before, and I'm not sure why what you just said triggered this thought. But Rick and Morty x SpongeBob, what would happen? You know, there's endless possibilities. A whole multiverse of bubbles and portals. I don't have a clincher for this bit, but...
Okay, well, I'm just now thinking, like, SpongeBob and the Warner siblings. Like, who would out-annoy the other?
Could the Warners out-annoy Rick? Rick and Morty x SpongeBob x Animaniacs.
Don't all of you have somewhere to be?
Squidward having to interact with all of these incredibly annoying characters. Just Squidward, the show, and it's every cartoon crosses over. The Squidward talk show.
We're up far too late. I'm Squidward. Go to bed.
So the Squidward talk show would be a great format for seeing characters interact that are from dramatically different animation styles. Like the 1960s experimental animation with like more modern or like more 90s animation. That would be really weird to see, and I would watch it.
I really want this to happen now.
Gerald McBoing-Boing and BMO would be nice. You know, like Gerald McBoing-Boing, the boy who makes sounds instead of talking. Yeah. The end.
Okay. Were there any things that people wanted to say before we wrap it up?
I always wanted to meet and hang out with Bugs Bunny. I thought that would be the coolest shit in the world.
Maybe this is a super basic answer, but I'm just realizing that no one said this when we were talking about the question. It would be really cool to see a proper Warner Brothers Disney crossover where... like it's Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse, like what would happen? I'm just curious. Maybe that wouldn't work. Maybe that's why it's never happened. But, you know, maybe it'll be in Space Jam 3.
They're college roommates.
Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious. It's like they're not totally mature tunes yet. So they've got to like work out their differences. Oh, they're high school roommates and they apply to different colleges.
And they swap?
And yes.
I just booked a date, but they think it's with you.
I guess that it's time for...
The Old Switcher.
The Old Switcheroo.
I know I always get too far into the lore, but I do have a question about the lore. So Jessica Rabbit says that it's hard being who she is, and that's just how she was drawn. So my question is, how are toons created? Do they have animator creators? And who created, like, Toontown?
Well, Kate, when a pencil loves a paper very, very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we're going to wrap it up. Can you hand that back to Moises?
Hello!
Well, I hope that you're recovering swiftly.
Like, yeah, man. I'm so totally great right now.
Oh, well, I am hopeful that this is temporary.
Oh, if you know me, you know that it's not.
Well, can you tell me, has all of your memories, like, kind of converged? Do you remember watching the movie with everybody else?
I do. I feel like I've been on one plane of space-time for a lengthy amount of time now, and I'm hoping to stay here.
Excellent. So what was your experience like screening it with all of us?
Movies are always better watching them with other people. That's something that people who say, oh, everything should be on streaming. Well, everybody should come over to my living room because I enjoy watching movies with other people reacting to them. Some people seeing them for the first time, some people seeing them for the 17th time, some people seeing them for the 74th time. And yeah, it's a great movie that it had been a while since I had seen it with somebody who had never seen it before. And it's always great to hear some of those things that I think are in common, like people expecting Jessica Rabbit to be a rabbit if they didn't see the trailers and, you know, have it marketed to them like crazy, like we did when we were kids. And there's always something unique, something different, something interesting that comes from being able to tell that there is somebody in the room who's seeing something for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I had to like keep myself from like looking over. Did you miss that, Aaron? You petting the cats too much?
That's a visual joke, Bailey. This is an audio format.
Okay, so for anyone listening, I was like, how do I even describe this?
Bailey is currently doing a really crazy thing with her head. It's hilarious.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. So thank you so much for choosing this movie, Moises.
Thank you for locking me in your time machine for 3 weeks.
I didn't do that.
I thank you, time machine, for locking me inside yourself for 3 weeks.
Yeah, you probably should. We really don't know what...
I should see a doctor. I mean, that's... I think I should see a doctor.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad idea.
Or a physicist. Or both.
Yeah, let's get you there. Okay, so thank you, everybody, for coming. And until next time...
Squidward's late night talk show. Squidward's late night talk show.
Go to bed.
You're watching Animation Station, playing cartoons all decade. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
I'm in the pink, my grass is green, I'm feeling good about everything.
The sky is so blue and all the roses red, I got a bunch of dreams forming up in my head.
My past is golden,
hey, so is mine,
I wish I could share
so
it,
so do I all the time.
Hey, I have an idea,
I have one too,
oh, why live just one life when we could live two?
The answer is simple,
the old switcheroo.
How clear is the sky,
how sweet is the rose,
how does that grass feel between your toes?
Now that we're living in each other's clothes.
Swapping places, but nobody knows.
What's mine is now yours, what's yours is now mine. Nobody the wiser, no one's dropping the line.
I just booked a date, but they think it's with you.
I guess that it's time for
the old switcher.
The old switcheroo.
The Memory Static Podcast is hosted and edited by Bailey Moore, with original score and additional sound editing by Indigo Starbeam. The slow-moving time machine is voiced by... Original song is written by Bailey Moore and Indigo Starbeam. Find more music at IndigoStarbeam.com. To learn more about the film events, follow Memory Static Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. If you like the show, please consider donating to our Patreon. If you have stories to share about any movie we've covered, please write us at memorystatic@gmail.com. Special thanks to our guest,
Moises Chuyan.
And thank you to all of our party guests. And thank you for listening. Goodbye.